time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we're here to record our podcast for the fifth episode of the first season of AMC's Fear the Walking Dead. This one was called Cobalt. This one starts with a pan down from the top of an impromptu holding cell, just chain link and an American flag and a bunch of people standing around.
There's an impassioned speech being given by the only thing I can describe as sort of a tent revival type preacher. He asks the question basically to me, am I a buyer? Am I a closer?
He identifies himself as definitely a closer.
And I think we can identify old Nick, who shows up in that same cell area, as a buyer.
The man in question is credited as Strand, but we just call him the closer because
that's pretty much what this guy is. So he's talking, and the whole time he's talking, his speech is so...
Something doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem real. So the funny thing is, as I'm watching this, I was writing, wait, is this the show or is this a bad ad?
It sounds like a dub or a voiceover or something. It just has a little bit larger than life quality, and the whole pattern of everything that he says and the way he says it is not the way anyone I've ever heard say anything ever.
Not in real life, in person. Certainly. I mean, it comes off very preachery. So it turns out that the man he is preaching to here is our old friend Doug.
Doug Thompson. Starts at about a 3, and Strand, the closer, whittles him down to about a negative 10 by the time he's done.
He is basically telling him the silver lining of his mental breakdown here is that
his wife is still in pretty good shape.
Yeah, so she is very likely to find a strapping fellow who's going to help her get through this end of days.
So he's got that to look forward to.
There's that. He's got that going for him. We then witness the total and utter meltdown of Doug.
And I guess you're not allowed to be a grown man and start crying in the government holding cell, because once that happens, the guards come and take you away.
Let that be a lesson to you.
I'm not exactly sure why that is the case, but now it's good to know that
I'm identifying this particular area as like the mentally weak area. This is what I'm calling it. So because it's shown that Nick is in there, and we know that he is grappling with this addiction, and that is making him mentally unstable. Now we have Doug, who we know is just fighting against everything to try to hold it together.
Well, we know that the rule that he broke was trying to escape. We're not sure what rule Nick broke overtly. We just know that he is a drug addict. So we know that this cell houses just a broad selection of people.
I just think it's the mentally unstable. That's what I think is the category.
After the closer works through Doug, he turns to Nick and says, "And who the hell are you?" As if he's just making his way through the holding cell one person at a time.
Definitely sizing everybody up.
Back at the safe zone gate, the area between the army camp and the safe zone, Ophelia is chucking things at the gate, breaking glass, yelling at the army, trying to rouse the rabble, the onlookers, trying to get them to stand up with her and see what she saw when the army came and took her mom out of the house.
Her words really reminded me of the types of poems and stories that came out of World War II of people who were being taken away. The general sentiment of, if you don't stand up now, who will stand up for you when they come for your family? This is really starting to affect the soldiers, and we see a lot of interaction, some for, some against, some just losing all conviction for even being there anymore.
One soldier starts to make his way toward the fence. A Humvee swerves into the scene, and our familiar corporal, I can't seem to catch his name, jumps out and kind of intervenes and heads off the sergeant and says, "Let me go deal with her."
This is her love interest. This is Ophelia's love interest,
yes,
corporal.
From the previous episode.
Right.
He makes his way out to the fence and tries to talk her down, which he does. witnessing all of this, another just random soldier who I don't particularly recognize.
I think he's remembering family, and he's remembering what it is to not just stomp into an area and take out people, but basically those more tender moments that you don't have to kill somebody. You could have walked over and just talked to her.
I think it's that in all likelihood, he probably hasn't heard from his own family in 2 weeks or more.
Right.
That's my guess. And so they don't show us exactly what happens. They just show that he decides in front of everybody, including his commanding officer, to desert right then.
Well, he just turns on his heel and he starts to walk down the hill, and the camera pans away as his commanding officer is striding over to him. So we pretty much know what's going to happen. He's at minimum going to get whomped, and maybe I was kind of anticipating a gunshot, to be honest.
The next shot shows Maddie sitting at her dining room table, and it looks like she and Travis have made up.
And definitely trying to come up with the next plan for what are they going to do, what's happening here.
Travis wants to go talk to Moyers, and just as he and Maddie are going over the plan, a very persnickety
hot talking.
Chris happens on the scene, and he wants to know specifically what's going to be done to try to get Liza back.
I thought this scene was kind of awesome in that Travis is like, you know, we're trying to figure out the plan. You know, you just need to be patient, what have you. And Madison starts to be like, we're all looking out for you. And Chris pulls this out of his back pocket and he's all, Madison, will you please not interrupt when we are discussing family matters? Ooh, look at him. Like, he practically like waggled his little finger at her.
Travis comes and picks him up by the scruff of the neck. And carries
right?
him out of the room.
But man, this push and pull of Travis, which family is he going to align with on any given day when he has the moment, as we all know is coming, that Sophie's Choice moment? Who is he going to pick? Will it be Chris and Liza? Will it be Maddie, Nick, Alicia? Who will he go for?
For all of Chris's bluster, he more or less reveals that he is mad and sad that Liza just left.
I think rejected is like the word I would use. That he was just incredulous that she just walked over to an army truck and hopped on. Which even to all of our eyes was like, wait, what? Like, she just like hopped in the back of the truck. How could you leave your kid like that?
She must have thought that with Travis there, he'd be okay. But that she wasn't going on very much.
I'm just letting you know, as mom, given all those circumstances, the idea that that bond would have been like completely okay to just walk away from and be like, well, she kind of acted like Travis had been this float in, float out kind of parent. Like, you can't change your visitation times, Travis, in previous episodes. Then now all of a sudden you're all just like, Dad's got you. Check you later. Like, wait, what?
Don't forget to feed your fish. Right.
Exactly.
Travis takes up for Liza. He is the consummate peacemaker. He sticks up for her and says that she probably just wanted to help people and help Griselda. And so, you know, don't blame Liza for wanting to help people. And Chris more or less buys it. And
do you think that was her motivation?
Do I think that that was Liza's motivation? Well, I've seen the rest of the episode, and I know that she does, not so much for Nick, but she does try to look after Griselda.
I just think it was that inflated ego that Dr. X like really talked her into what a valuable, valuable asset she was. And I just think that as just sort of a student who really hadn't had a really great lot in life here, I feel like she felt like,
I think that's got to be
what?
Part of it.
I am awesome. And she just hopped on the awesome wagon and like headed out.
I'm going to go with Dr. X.
Mm-hmm.
One important thing that happens that still demonstrates where Chris and his feelings toward Travis's other family are is that Travis tries to insist that Chris apologize to Maddie for what he says. And rather than do that, Chris just takes off out the back door and says, go be with your family.
Yikes.
Okay, so we finally get a look at this super secret military hospital in the next shot with Liza and Dr. X. Liza's suturing up some miscellaneous laceration.
We get a nice zoom in on her technique.
Dr. X is basically supervising, we can see that there are not very many figures vertical.
And it's definitely seeming like Dr. X is the only doctor that we're seeing. It's not like there's a bunch of medical staff walking around.
Well, she describes that Liza is one of only, what, three current nurses?
I don't know, but I never even feel like I saw the other current nurses. Or nobody, like, identified. Or, like, nobody where Liza was like, hi, I'm Liza. And they're like, hi, I'm Heidi. I'm the nurse, too. Like nobody says anything. There's no, like, you know, there's no, like, ER kind of like, oh, Dr. Jojo. Like, you know, there's just nothing. There's just, like, Dr. X is leading the show.
Now, I think that this is probably not the day after they took them. Because that's the way the rest of the show worked. I mean, the last episode had 9 days in between. So I'm kind of assuming a couple days have gone by. But maybe not.
So maybe she's already done staff orientation and introductions. They already had, like, a cake and... They passed, right. They played like some sort of break the ice games.
She took the back
whatnot.
Safety CBT.
Exactly. Lift with your legs and all that kind of stuff. And like everyone like, you know, passed around like what's your favorite color and did like word association games and whatnot. They're like zombie, dead. No, wait, can I go again?
If that's true, then what I just said about her going along for the sake of watching over Griselda would be wrong because... It's exposition and it needs to be delivered somehow, but it's delivered right now by Liza asking Dr. X, hey,
by the way,
whatever happened to Griselda?
Remember the Grizz? Where's the Grizz?
And she's like, oh, yeah, we took her foot.
Yeah, they totally amputated that bad, but really? Shoot.
Oh, really? It's gone.
Future's wicked, dude. They're just like, you know what? We're not even going to waste any antibiotics on you.
Maddie insists on keeping a clean house through the zombie apocalypse. She won't even let Alicia slacken off, so she goes into her room to make her bed, and she finds Alicia's bedtime reading stuck between the pillows. Susu's suicide note.
Oh, Susu. And it also looks like she has gone ahead and helped herself to the framed art from Susu's house and has made herself a little Susu shrine on her bedside.
This gets Maddie to go a-looking for Alicia.
Because, shockingly, despite the fact that all this freaking crap is happening, and someone just snatched her son, they just let the kids just wander the area, like, whatevs. Like, an army guy could completely just snatch him off the street and be like, oh, you look sick. Sorry, come with me. And Maddie's not, like, sitting outside monitoring nothing. It's just all like, I'm in here. I'm, like, pressing the shirts. Like, okay.
Carolyn okay, and I Maddie. Have noticed... a possible, let's call it, budgetary limitation to Fear the Walking Dead. I think that that might come up in the way that they have to reuse the expensive sets that they have built. Because this gives us a great reason to go back to the trans house where we have already seen that they've put in these nice, interesting lights overhead. And It's a set that we've got, so why don't we use it?
Right, so the first place that she runs to go find Alicia is Susu's house. Perhaps she's in Susu's house playing games and doing stuff, so she's going to go try to find her. But instead, she finds a strange noise coming from, apparently, where do all strange noises come from in a horror movie?
Well, it's either the attic or the basement.
And this is going to be the basement, friend.
So that bears investigation all by yourself.
Always. And you're going to need to not tell anybody where you're going. And
don't turn on lights. Always just take a flashlight that you need to kind of hit in the palm of your other hand to make sure that the light comes on.
That makes good sense. At least she took a giant knife because she seemed ready to slash necks in the secure zone.
So this is very typical for Fear the Walking Dead.
For sure. They pumped on the pounding heartbeat music. So it's like boom, 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 boom.
We didn't expect to find what we did find, which was...
What totally wigged me out is the first time she came around the first corner and there was like clothing or something that was like on a hanger. It wigged me the heck out because it was like an outfit was like, it appeared to have like scrawny legs under it. I was like, oh, what is that? And it was like, oh.
It's did you think
like,
it was Chucky?
I don't really know. It was like Susu's delicates that were like, it was like her nylons or something. But it wigged me out. I was like, oh no. Like there is definitely some sort of creeper hanging out down here.
Not a creeper.
Well, kind of a creeper, but a different kind of creep.
Just Daniel, Ophelia, and Corporal down on his luck.
I'm going to call him Lover Boy. If I were starting off my morning making beds, okay, and then I found this super sad note and I think, oh, my kid is probably sad somewhere, so I'm going to go find her. Then I come into my sad neighbor's house and I hear a very scary sound. So I'm going to take a giant knife and I'm going to go check it out. And when I get there, what do I find but a taped up army soldier and Papa Salazar and Ophelia listening on the radio. So am I completely upset? No. After like 2 seconds of assessing the situation, I'm like, well, are you getting the answers here? Like, what's going on? You answer the questions. Like, she just like joins right in on the interrogation. Like, she's like, oh, yo, y'all, I thought this was starting after lunch. I was going to make some paninis. And then I thought we were getting to the interrogation. But hey, I'm here now. Let's just go forward.
Ophelia kind of messes up the flow of the conversation between our heroes and the corporal. A look from Daniel kind of says, okay, we're going to clear the room and before things get started.
We have to clear the room. That's
and
no good.
Ophelia, Maddie, and Daniel go outside to kind of sort things out. This is where Ophelia reveals her naivete about what is actually going on by saying, This is what we're going to do. We're going to trade him for Mom. And
the Grizz.
And Daniel's like, yeah, see, this is how it's done.
He's like doing that movement behind her head like, no, we're not really going to do that. He's like flapping his hands like, this is stupid. Don't listen to her.
Ophelia steps out and Maddie's like, this is dumb. And Daniel's like, I know
no
that's
crap,
dumb.
No crap, it's dumb. You think I was going to go with that plan? Papa reveals, like, obviously, we're going to have to hurt him here. And Maddie's all giving him this look like, and I love it. Papa puts our feet to the fireman. He's like, so let me just be clear. You don't want me to hurt him, or you just don't want to know that I'm going to hurt him?
Oh, no, that's not it. It's that you don't want me to hurt him, or you don't want to know about Nick. That's the trade.
So then she's all just like, do what you got to do.
That is exactly how
things go. Giddy up, Papa Salazar.
Yes, that is what happens. Back at the army camp, Travis and Moyers are having sort of a instructional discussion.
And I'm going to say, too, like a little revealing of motivations.
Travis is just looking for answers, and Moyers is trying to do a few things. He's trying to let Travis know all of the pressures behind being in command and what it's like to have to lead these men who...
They're not really men, but they're really just sort of like glorified.
They're National Guardsmen, so he kind of feels like, I don't know, he's kind of looking down on them in some way.
This is also that they're very young. They're just very young. He's not sitting here dealing with experienced soldiers. And he's very clear. He says, I have to keep talking about what we need to do and going in and keeping these guys being busy. Because otherwise, dark thoughts become the enemy. He kind of relates to Travis like, you are a teacher and, you know, you understand that you kind of got to keep the kids busy. You know, it's sort of the old idle hands or the devil's playground. Like, sort of like if these guys aren't out here kicking up a little dirt, then basically they're sitting crying, worrying about their moms.
The first half of this conversation has this result. I am not going to let you talk to Dr. X. He basically says, this is Dr. X's show. I'm here to basically stand in the way of anyone interrupting her. Travis makes what sounds like a threat. Something about the way you're treating us, you may find us coming for you, basically.
Yeah, basically, well, like, we're going to rise up against you guys. There's a lot of us.
Moyers says, okay, I'll take you to Dr. X.
But see, I think this is one of those winks like, oh, you are very strong. I think, you know what, let's go. Let's just forget about all the other things we're going to do today. Let's all gather our crap together and go see Dr. X. I don't think there was any part of that that was about being cool and going to see Dr. X. This was all about like, hey, Trav, we're going to take you on a little field trip. We're going to teach you what's going on in the world.
Travis is like, hey, a second ago you couldn't, and now you can. Moyer's entire outlook on command and structure in the world is outlined by the, hey, I can do whatever I want. I got guns.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Which knowing Travis's like whole opinion on guns, kind of think that would have been like the big warning, like, dude, don't go. Don't go. They're going to start pushing you around, Trav. Like, you do not want to go. He's looking at you in the face and saying, I can make anyone do anything I want, whenever I want, because I have the guns. Trav, just go home. Go find out what the hell Maddie's up to.
Moyers has a problem showing any amount of respect to both the civilian populace and his own men. And this, I think, will catch up with him.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I don't think you can act like that ever and not expect it to come back and bite you in the dupe.
Dupe means ass.
Ah, Daily, I'll tell all my business.
Back in the trans basement. That's funny. You know, we only have like two sets, I guess. And one of them's a trans basement.
The trans. Susu's little craft room has turned into a needlepoint to hell.
Daniel's fun parlor.
No.
Daniel, he's already taken one layer off. We knew that there was more to this barber than met the eye.
Absolutely. The whole time I've been like, Papa's got stories. He's got a wicked past here.
Every time Daniel opened up his mouth this episode, Caroline would start to laugh because he wasn't saying, he never said a single funny thing, but she had already decided that he,
like in episode one,
was a storyteller, and he did not disappoint in this episode.
Oh no, and he told it in the ways that you would tell children's stories. I don't know, it was awesome. So as soon as we get back to Papa's room of terror, if you will, I saw this terribly horrible sign you do not want to see when your captor starts removing clothing off of themselves.
And he starts unzipping small leather cases.
Yeah, and like laying out. Yeah, no. This is like the time when you just pee your pants, my friend. And I'm sorry, but if I'm duct taped down, I'm like, what do you want to know? Because taking your clothes off can mean nothing good for me.
I'm happy to report that I live tweeted that Daniel was about to get out his straight razor a whole minute before he actually did.
Oh my God, you're like Karnak. You're like, right. You're like a yeah. Papa, a story, and a razor.
Right. I can only foresee torture.
Torture.
Methods.
That sounds right.
It hasn't come up a whole lot just yet.
Well, thankfully, that's going to be a good thing. We shoot on over to Travis. He is in the car with his newfound soldier buddies. They're just out on a little joyride, really.
And they're giving him a hard time about his mission to go and save a kid that's not his, a woman that's not his, and an ex-wife.
How do they say, like, a woman you're interested or something? And he says, she's my ex-wife. And they're all, woo! Like, they're all like, oh my God, what kind of twisted domestic situation do you have going on?
Moyers insists that they stop. He's been riding in the turret. And he's noticed a walker that he wants to stop and take care of.
It's good you're on this podcast because I would never know the word turret.
Yeah, that's the thingy on top of the truck with the gun.
The thing that yeah, that's what I would have said. The thingy on the top of the truck with the gun. The gun thinger.
So they stop the Humvee.
Oh.
Yes.
All this technical jargon. Spin in my head.
They start to go back and forth about how many points for this one and yada, yada, yada.
You know what
it's
I wrote
clear
on my
that
note?
They've gotten super informal about this duty these days.
I wrote on my note, ugh.
They get out a gigantic weapon.
Is that the Mamba by any chance?
I believe that's what he was referring to when he said Mamba.
Does that mean, is it like a black Mamba?
I assume.
It's like a poisonous snake.
They put it on the vehicle. They fold down its little mounts and they line it up. And Moyers wants Travis to do the deed.
This starts setting up this dynamic of basically whether you are going to be the shooter or the one that is going to be shot. And
the closer or the buyer, if
right,
you will.
Exactly. Are you the closer? Are you the buyer? What is your scene here? And so we've seen this dynamic before in other movies and shows where there's basically like this person who is at least walking around behaving as if he is, you know, his hands have no blood on it and he is just sort of the righteous man. And the people who have had to go out and do the dirty work are kind of sick of it. They're ready to basically push the envelope and say, you know, if you're going to look down on us because the things we do protect you, you know what? Why don't you step up and get your hands dirty once in a while and at least know where we're coming from? And also to kind of prove like that he doesn't look down on them as being these awful murderers, but that he gets it, that there's a reason why they're doing the things they are.
Travis tries to beg off, but he eventually does line up on the weapon. It's a big, scary weapon that you got to open your mouth because the recoil will pop your eye or something like that. And he
clearly were NRA members.
Sights up and down the walker, and he can see that it's a young woman, and she's wearing a name tag in a donut store. Her name is Kimberly. And it's my bet that given that she's probably a teenager or at least a young person, I bet he recognizes her. It's the combination of he doesn't like guns. He's got all these men breathing down his neck.
Yeah, kind of just chiding.
And I think he recognizes her. He just can't do it. So he doesn't.
He steps off. He does. He steps off.
Moyer says something like, "That's what I thought." And he goes and pulls the trigger, and that's it for Kimberly.
Kimberly gets blown away.
Radio comes to life, and they can hear that there's another squad somewhere nearby that is in deep, as my son would say, ooh!
Which is Tourette's talk for swear word. He just goes, ooh! That's his censorship sound.
Self-censoring.
Yep.
So awesome. They get in the Humvee and drive off.
We meet back up with Liza again on triage, and she is busy trying to get a soldier cleaned up.
A new batch of torn up soldiers have come in. They peel back either a bandage or a shirt, a jacket or something,
jacket, yeah.
And they see what looks to be bite marks. And this sends Dr. X.
Dude, this is not just like a regular old bite, though. This is like a chompity chomp. Chomp, like it is like the person stuck their entire shoulder like the hawk or whatever the hell that part's called and like nibbled it up. Like I can't understand why I didn't rip his arm off.
So Dr. X pulls basically the bite alarm. She and Liza head off with the soldier that she believes that they can save. As they're doing so, Liza can see that there's a man remaining behind who is pressurizing some kind of tool. He's got a tank, he's got a hose, he's got some other kind of handheld thing, and she can't tell what he's about to do because she's got to go help Dr. X.
I totally thought at first that this was like an oxygen tank for breathing, and so I thought he was like turning off the oxygen tank, so I thought it was sort of more like he was killing him, basically. Again, I made note here that Dr. X seems to be running the whole place. She is running this entire joint, but it's like was really crazy to me to think back that only one episode ago, she was just making house calls in the neighborhood, just like, hey, everybody, what's going on? All casual and everything. And then it seemed like there's no other doctors in this entire place. And yet they seem to be running like an emergency room and doing surgeries.
And what's kind of weird is that Moyers is definitely in the military, but Dr. X doesn't seem to be wearing any kind of uniform or insignia or anything like that. So
not when she's in the hospital and not when she was out in the neighborhood.
Now, I've never been in the military, but I don't know what kind of structure has a military guy yielding authority to a civilian in this kind of situation.
Well, and especially Moyers, just as the personality he has. We turn our attention back over to the army guys who are outside back with Travis, and they have found the library, and they said that they thought that there were some people who had held out inside, like squatters, basically.
We overhear the army say a bunch of stuff like, they must be holdouts that don't trust the government. And someone else says something like, who can blame them? Or, you know, something like that.
Snicker. The library, though, when it comes to a zombie apocalypse, all I can think back to is our good friends Abraham and Rosita getting it on in the nonfiction section.
Sleepover with Eugene and friends.
I don't know if it's considered as a sleepover with Eugene as much as, like, Eugene was like the, oh, I don't know, the
creeper.
Creeper on that situation.
Creeper from periodicals.
Exactly. So this was one of those times when the production value of the show was a little questionable. Thin. Yeah, because we definitely had a very narrow,
claustrophobic view of this set
for sure. Now, this is supposed to be the very first time for us as a group to be coming out of our pocket of the fenced-in area. We're supposed to be participating almost in this army battle versus what we think is a horde of zombies inside of a building. Rather than showing any of that in any type of action-packed kind of way, they used Travis sitting in the truck just simply listening to the action on the radio.
He was just reacting, and Caroline pointed it out to me, and then all of a sudden I was just reminded of very old TV shows like The Twilight Zone or The Outer Limits or BBC shows like Doctor Who or something, where the budget wouldn't allow for them to figure out how to make an alien spacecraft land. But they could make an alien spacecraft sound effect, and they could tell the actor to make it look like
make
he was
like,
watching
oh
an alien
God,
spacecraft landing.
I'm looking at an alien spacecraft land on the Earth. It's just now touching the Earth. That's exactly what it was like. Like, Travis is like listening, and the soldiers are like, oh no, someone is here. No, it's all going bad. The zombies are winning. The zombies are killing all of us. Like, it's very, very, very like listening to a radio show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's like a podcast of the zombie apocalypse.
you could rationalize it in the idea that although the premise of the show is to show us what happened in the weeks right in the middle of the zombie outbreak emergency, they've decided to focus on basically these civilians and their story. Although Travis is with them, he's still in the truck. His story is that of what happens out in the truck.
At no point in time have we taken the viewpoint of an army soldier. So I guess that totally makes sense that why would the camera follow the soldiers in?
I would have liked to have seen a little bit of, you know, chain gun
action. I don't know. I mean, I have sat through plenty of unnecessary action-packed times. You would think in the story,
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
Every bit of action that
it's
I've taken
totally
you to
justified.
Has been
right.
Very, yes,
yeah,
important.
I misspoke there. That was all very, very important business. However, in this particular case, I think I would have liked the door to be propped open or something and me to perhaps see a little bit of the action.
We did not. Down in Tran's basement,
Susu's sewing room. We begin again with story time with Papa. This story, the way he told it,
it's another layer being peeled back on what we.
Oh, you're gonna keep saying layer peeled back, and it's gonna keep grossing me out because it's just gonna keep thinking of.
I mean it like onions and ogres, a la Shrek.
Not forearms and razors.
No, not dermis and subdermal tissue. No.
Oh my God. Well, so this is how story time with Papa sounds. There's a fence around a building. Inside the building, there's a room, and inside the room, there is a chair. Just like this one in Susu's house. It totally reminded me of that song where it's like, there's a hole in the bottom of the sea. There's a log in the hole in the bottom of the sea. There's a frog on the log on the bottom of the sea. It was like cracking me up. I looked up, I was like, what, wait, what now? This story time is just like next he's going to pull out like puppets and be like, sing with me.
Well, he gets to a point, and the point is that there's no difference between the man in the chair and the man with the blade. And the question, though, is which man will you be? Which is the big question for all of the pairs set up in this episode.
So this is the pattern that we found. Basically, that they're going to ask you in each different scenario, which guy are you going to be? So
the guy at the beginning,
right, he says, are you going to be the closer or the buyer? And then we had Travis and Moyer. And the question was, are you going to be the shooter or the one that to be shot? And then Papa and the soldier, it was, you know, are you the one in the chair or the man with the blade? So I do think that this is sort of setting you up for like the big grand question of this particular time, which is when it all falls apart, where did you land? it did bring back the story that Papa was telling Maddie about the idea that, is there a difference between an evil man and a man who does evil things out of fear? And in that particular story, he was coming down on the side that it doesn't matter. Like, the deed is the deed, and it doesn't matter your motivation, whether you hurt someone or kill someone out of fear, or you hurt or kill someone because you're truly evil. But it did beg the question of the viewer, does it matter? You know, are you an evil person, or are you somebody who just does something evil out of fear? And I think that that did sort of start pushing us into these questions, like, are you the closer or the buyer? Are you the shooter? Are you the one that gets shot? And from Papa's point of view, he's trying to say that men can sit on the top of a mountaintop and try to tease it all out. Who, what, where, why did this all go down? But at the end of the day, if you're dead, you're dead. And if somebody did something horrible to you because they're evil or because they were forced to, none of it matters. It just matters what's the end result.
The radio crackles to life and mentions something about cobalt. Daniel has noticed that it is saying the word cobalt several times over the course of their torture session.
Gross.
And he wants to know more about it.
Speaking of the torture session, this is also when he kind of folds back the soldier's, I'm not even sure why it's folded down to begin with, but he kind of folds back to do this like reveal. And it shows that he's been using the razor to basically like,
just kind of carve up the top layer of skin on his forearm.
Which is a really, I have zero stomach for like for torture type things.
Still?
But this is a particularly just like kind of strange one. I mean, have you ever seen?
Well, Daniel describes what he's doing and why he's doing it. He's making it hurt about as much as you think it can hurt for as long as it can last that way. But he's telling him, you ain't seen nothing yet.
But I'm saying, like, most of the time, they, like, punch people in the face. Or they, you know, we see a lot of, like, battering of the head and stuff like that. But just
maybe not
in
El Salvador. Maybe they go straight for the forearms.
But just to do this, like, deli slicer, like, thin slice of, like, cutting off of your forearm. I don't know. Maybe it's a particular method known to barbers. It's like take a little off the top kind of move.
I don't think I'm ever going to visit a barber from El Salvador in my life.
Not anymore. You're going to walk in here and be like, no, thank you, sir. You're like, walk out. So next we have a little comic relief Muppet routine between Alicia and Chris. Alicia is outside riding on a
goofy big girl's bicycle.
And Chris is, you know, doing what we all do in the afternoon, sit on a roof of a car. I can't even tell you how long I sat on the roof of the car today.
Holding our knees, sulking.
I just can't.
I always catch you out there.
I know. I'm like, Paul, you know what? I think I'm just going to go sit on the roof of the car for a while.
Now, we haven't ever seen Alicia try to be cute or funny.
I don't think she's trying to be cute. I think she's trying to be funny.
Well,
I know you think funny girls are cute. I appreciate you on that.
It works that way. Chris agrees. And so they go and find some trouble together.
Well, so Alicia's like giving all this biz. I thought she was actually funny and I thought she delivered the lines well. So props to the actress playing Alicia, because I've given her some a little bit of grief in the past, but I feel like that this, she did a good job. She delivered it. So they decide that they're going to go and find a rich person's house, which is a little bit confusing because, as Paul said in the story sync last week, they showed that the secured areas are really just a couple of streets in a neighborhood.
And the likelihood of this awesome house being close to their house
within a couple of streets seems like a little like,
I don't want to cast aspersions here, but it does. I just know how neighborhoods work.
Right. And they're living pretty modestly. I mean, we've gotten a chance to see the trans house.
Yeah, like Travis has a 30-year-old truck, and it's not a collector's item, you know?
Well, we saw the Clark's house, the Tran's house, the Thompson's house, and all of them have been very modest homes.
We can see Alicia starts playing with the clothing and jewelry.
Now, we have, like, an ongoing joke in our family that, like, anytime anyone's in charge of watching my parents' house, I'll always be like, so are you going to wear Mimi's clothes around, and you're going to put on Papa's clothes and be like, hi, Mimi! me. Look at me. So, like, we always have, like, this ongoing joke that, like, anytime someone's not home, like, the first thing you're going to go do is, like, go put on their clothes and then start, like, walking around the house and behaving like you're them.
Turns out that's what Alicia does.
It turns out that's what people do, I guess. I thought it was a joke, but no. So, Chris and Alicia, like, completely put on the fanciest duds they can find. And Alicia, turns out that she's got some mad skills as a hairdresser, makes up, like, a fancy hairdo and does her makeup and everything.
Chris kind of catches an eyeful of Alicia while she's sort of slinking or
well, she's
something.
She's kind of glamming it up in the mirror. She's kind of, yeah, they're playing this song called like Classic Girl. She's such a classic girl. It keeps playing. And they do have this super strange flowers in the attic, brother, sister, kind of looking at each other like, you know, like
he gets embarrassed and kind of excuses himself.
But the thing that kind of wigged me out was that Alicia totally sees that he was eyeing her up and that he kind of ran away. And she like looks at herself in the mirror, lets the dress like kind of fall down a little more on her shoulder and gives herself this like.
I'm sure Matt would totally approve of this behavior.
What kind of smile, though, would you say? She like smiles at herself in the mirror. Like,
coy.
Kind of proud of herself, right? Like, oh, I just totally got that guy. And he's like my practical stepbrother. Like, I'm pretty hot.
I did elbow him in the nose the other night.
Paul themed this section as acting like no one is looking. And I think that that is an excellent theme for this section. I also wrote down on my notes that we had some pretty classic horror movie moves so far in this episode. We had Maddie venturing down in the don't go down in the basement moment. And now we're having the teens getting all lusty and going through the adult stuff, getting drunk a little bit, doing all kinds of stuff that is like, teens, you're not supposed to in any way act sexy during a horror movie.
Classic rules.
Because you are definitely going to get stuck.
They must be completely ignorant of all chapters of Friday the 13th.
And Scream in every other movie. As soon as teens start having fun, killers do not put up with that, okay? And you know what they really are against? Premarital teen sex and any sexy moves.
And neither do they go for those shenanigans back in the holding cell where Nick and the closer are hanging out. And they're undergoing a little spot fever check. Army guys have that kind of fancy thermometer that you can just aim at somebody's head and it tells if there's a fever or not. Closer, no fever. Nick, fever.
101.1. Yeeks. Take that coat off.
So they're going to take Nick away because he's obviously, you know, near death. With that 101 fever.
He's showing signs of infection, Paul.
And the closer won't let it go. He identifies a guard and says, hey, you know, we made a deal before, and if you would leave the boy, maybe we can make another deal.
Now, this is one of those funny moments of the end of the world times when people forget what is actually worth anything. Rather than him like trading things like, I don't know, food, water, something that's like actually like a commodity at the end of days, they have a moment where they're actually going to dicker with one another about whether one cufflink or two cufflinks will cover the cost of Nick's life. Now, I am not quite sure what the soldier is planning to attend that he feels that two new cufflinks will surely make him stand out in the crowd.
The general's ball.
But he is adamant that he's going to get both cufflinks if this teen ne'er-do-well is going to come back to the holding barbed wire
tank. The closer drives a pretty hard bargain himself, so he does give both cufflinks for Nick's return. Back at the library, we're zoomed in just so that we can see.
Let's just say nobody's being quiet in the library.
The front door of the library, and the army guys come running out, and a couple of walkers start to make their way out of the library. In what Caroline described as like the saddest grenade explosion in movie special effects history.
I just said that like the whole little set there because they kept a really tight, narrow view. It's like they were like, everyone go back to your dressing rooms and bring your chairs and put your chairs all over the stairs. And then we're going to throw like this firecracker. And then what's going to happen is everyone on this side of the wall, just push the wall over. Okay? So it's like, work together, team. Ready? Let's go.
And the army guys come and swarm the Humvees, and they let Travis know that Moyer's time on the planet is over, and they are getting out of there.
They're going to ditch the mission, too, to do anything having to do with the army. They are going to find their families. So then they give Travis the awesome news that they are going to drop him a few blocks from home, and he can simply meander on back to the enclosure.
So this has been just a super productive day for
Travis. For old Trav, this has been pretty fantastic. He's going to probably sign up for this next field trip when they have another.
We're not done in the trans basement, not by a long shot. Daniel still has more stories to tell.
Ophelia is screaming and running up through the kitchen. Maddie comes into the kitchen and meets up with Papa. And now we play the cue the music for story time with Papa.
This is the most interesting final layer of Daniel's cover. He basically lets us know that where he's been leading us through his stories, you probably should have been believing that he had been suffering at the hands of a government man torturing him.
Or his family, and that they were on the run from the torturers.
All of a sudden, we find out he's the torturer.
And so this entire time, as he's sitting there, really gruesomely cleaning his
straight razors and
all of his accoutrements there that he has in his little bowl of terror.
Picks and prods.
He basically reveals that all this time, he was actually the enforcer.
I tweeted, oh my God, Daniel is Saeed.
He actually seems remorseful about this, but also just sort of...
Well, only because he's never wanted to admit it to Ophelia.
So I don't want to say, remorseful is the wrong word. I want to say that he seems heartbroken that this is the way the world is, but violence was necessary then to survive, and it is now. His voice breaks a little bit, but not because he's like sorry for what he's done, but it's just more like it is what it is, and this is how the world works.
This is a very emotional scene. We've learned a lot about Daniel in this scene. And we learn a lot about Maddie in this scene. Maddie could conduct a seminar in how to move on.
Exactly. Because she absorbs the screaming Ophelia, the complete confession of Papa that he was actually the torturer. And she just looks right past him and says, did he tell you what we needed to know? and
those beans, were they spilled yet?
Exactly. And we're going to have ham for dinner. So anyway, you're going to want to clean up that sink because those straight razors are a hazard.
Right.
I mean, that was it. She wasn't like, my God, or we're in danger, or you guys are going to need to start sleeping at the trans house because I don't think I want your straight razors in our house anymore. Nope, none of those things. Just totally all right, cool. Good talk.
Right. Do you want corn with dinner tonight? Back at the field hospital, Liza is going on a tour, and we see a lot of weird stuff. People in cages and...
lots of barbed wire.
And she is on the lookout for Griselda, who she finally finds in another cage, just somewhere else. And she's like, Griselda! Griselda!
I'm going to keep calling her the Grizz.
And who is lurking in the shadows but...
the one and only doctor that presides over the entire field hospital, Dr. X.
And Dr. X is hurt. She's like, I told you she was in recovery, and everybody knows recovery is these cages here.
Right? We told you she was in the dog kennel. She does break the news that Griselda...
is in septic shock, and...
the Grizz is not going to make it.
No, she got infected and sick.
Alicia and Chris are continuing their risky business teen party. Now they're in their evening wear.
Chris is wearing what looks to be some very flashy, tuxedo top and shorts. And
children would. They're checking out the family photos. and sort of deciding that these people do not deserve to have such fancy things.
I think that's right. And they just go...
Well, they throw
the place.
Yeah, they throw the sheet off the piano, and I legitimately thought that Alicia was going to sit down and tickle the ivories for us.
I thought so too.
But instead of sitting down and playing us a little tune, they decide to just start smashing things. And they get like straight up inventive, like go get an entire armload of plates and then walk around, strut around while smashing them to the ground. Chris does some sort of cannonball move onto the couch and just continues to smash the chandeliers.
And they just do this till they get bored with it, I think.
Until it gets dark, basically. They're like, the street lights are coming on. Time to go home for dinner. I heard we're having ham.
They change back into their play clothes and get out of there.
So this started up another little theme that I put on here, which was called Bonding Through Bad Deeds. I identified Maddie and Papa bonding through torture, Alicia and Chris bonding through this dress up slash destroy the joint, and then we have Dr. X and Liza bonding in their own strange sort of secretive medical ways.
More on that in a sec. Before we get there,
Travis has made it back from those couple blocks. It was like, I could see them pulling up to the gate and Travis getting out and being like, bye, you guys. Good luck. And they're like, honk, honk, USA rules. Just like taking off.
He finds Ophelia crying, just sitting outside. And he wants to know what's up. She leads him back to the trans house. And he finds Maddie just hanging out at the kitchen table. Ophelia has told Travis what is going on, and Travis wants to know from Maddie, did she know what Daniel was up to?
The look in her face says, I knew, and I'm moving on.
Right, pretty much. We cut to downstairs before Travis can bust in, and the corporal is telling us a tale.
Well, hold up. So clearly, the corporal has broken.
Anything that could possibly be relevant, he is telling.
Yeah, he is now singing his songs. I don't know how far down on the forearm we had to slash, but now he's just like, let me just tell you all the deets about anything you want to know ever about anything.
And he's telling him about that they had to lock the doors on an arena full of people that were turning.
And that was the main deal, was that it was that there was a mixed group of, he said, like 2,000 people. And the army themselves couldn't figure out who was actual citizens.
This was sort of a Katrina sort of thing where they had obviously put people in a common area where they thought they could help them.
Like a Superdome type thing. And
it got out of hand.
And so basically he was like one of the last people to actually chain the doors closed.
Travis busts in. He starts to try to make like he's going to untie the guy. Daniel says, tell him about Cobalt. Instantly, he starts spilling the beans about Cobalt being a evacuation plan just for the army, where they will abandon the civilian populace and humanely terminate their prisoners back at HQ or the hospital.
Oh, I think they were going to humanely terminate all of them.
Oh, you think so?
Absolutely.
Oh, I thought it was more like...
No, I think that it was like they were going to humanely terminate Travis and Maddie and everybody else.
Interesting. I didn't see that, but okay.
And they said, when's it going to happen? They said, 9 a.m. tomorrow. And the first thing I said to Paul is I looked over and I sang him that old McDonald's jingle. I'm like, we've got a lot to do before lunch. Because I was like, oh, crap. 9 a.m. tomorrow. Like, we've got to figure out how to deal with everything.
They don't get any closer to figuring that out this episode. But you can tell that the wheels are turning in Travis's head as we cut back over to the closer and Nick in their holding cell.
Now we get a little bit more information about the closer and why he gives anything about Nick. So Nick says, why did you save me? And the closer
says,
so shrewd, says,
I didn't save you.
I obligated you. Which, man, oh man, I feel like that is a real life concept that I like absorbed. The idea of those people who go around and do stuff for people, and the entire time, They weren't doing it to be nice. They're doing it to obligate you to them. And I was like, oh, dang, dude, you just spoke some truth. And I heard that.
The closer is a very observant human being. He knows that Nick is not only an addict, but he is a heroin addict.
Which he describes as the gold standard of addicts. He's like, don't sell yourself short, man. You are the gold standard of addicts.
He also knows that the soldiers are leaving. And he has a plan. And to execute his plan, he needs a partner. I think somehow he's going to use Nick's heroin addiction to his advantage.
Addicts are the type of people that we've seen, Nick. He will do unscrupulous things to get what needs to be done. And so the way that he thinks is the way that the closer needs his partner to think.
I think that Nick either faked or caused himself to have that fit in the second episode where he...
The seizure, right?
To convince...
Alicia to stay.
Yeah. That kind of thing might come in handy again.
That's a really good way to get them to open the door for sure. It was funny because the way that the camera kind of pans back from the closer sitting on this like bench and Nick sitting on the floor, it was like the perfect screenshot for like the closer and Nick, like the outlaws. Like they were going to become like these buddies now. They could spin off to their own show.
So the closer has a key, he's got a plan, and now he has Nick.
We're going to head back and visit with the Grizz for a little last moment story time.
Griselda is kind of ranting and raving in Spanish. Dr. X is explaining that her brain is swelling, so she's probably not making any sense. And Liza, she's not telling Dr. X anything Griselda is saying because it doesn't make any sense to her. So she might as well not translate it. But since we have a little texture on Daniel now, the stuff that she's saying does seem to make some amount of sense. Like she's kind of coming.
She's saying that she was young. She remembered those nights where they were waiting for people to break down the door. She said she saw his face. She's now been shown the devil's face and that they're the same face. She says, basically, kind of out to the world, I know I'm going to hell and I know you're going to come and tear my skin off. You know what? I'm ready for that. I'm ready to see the devil. And now I know your nature, I think, meaning Papa Salazar's, and now you know mine.
I think she was talking to both Papa and just...
Liza and Dr. X or whatever.
No, like...
The world?
Yeah, the world slash God.
Because she had been the rosary-hugging, candle-lighting matriarch in the beginning part of this season.
Right.
And
this is her,
like,
kind of her deathbed confession.
Yeah.
Right?
And she's basically saying like
she knew what Daniel was and she abetted him in a way or was.
Yeah, that's the right word.
Complicit with him. And
she did what she did because she felt like she had to do it. But she wasn't remorseful for it at this point. She wasn't saying, I'm sorry I did the things I did. Like she wasn't repenting on her deathbed. She was like, now you know what I am, you know, like, and that's what I am. And that's the life I lived.
She seizes up, dies. Dr. X gives all of us everything that they know about zombiehood in about 10 seconds. That the time it takes for reanimation is variable, so they got to act fast. And only severe brain trauma will exterminate the walker. She doesn't say walker, but you know what I mean. So she has this handy pneumatic device that they use to put down animals at like livestock yards. And we recognized it as a version of the No Country for Old Men assassin's tool, if you will. She hands it to Liza to use on Griselda.
And this was that same moment again, that whole like, are you going to be the shooter or the one that is shot? Or, you know, trying to act like, you know, your hands cannot be without blood on them too. So you're going to have to start killing these people.
And
as
she
well.
Does what Travis couldn't.
Yeah. Liza pulls the trigger. So now we know her nature.
The show ends with Daniel kind of following up on the corporal's story.
So he is jogging up these large staircase. And at first, I didn't really know where we were at. At first, I was kind kind of thinking, are we near to the medical facility? Where are we? We could see that the chained doors were sort of pulsating.
Just bulging, and yeah, you could hear the behind there. The camera pulls back and we can see that he's outside of a big sports arena of some kind.
Yeah, it's like a Superdome type facility. So what the army soldier had told him was true, that there had to be at least like 2,000 people now all turned, certainly, and the building is just pulsating. You can see the whole thing is ready to just blow. So between having Cobalt being called on the radio and now Papa seeing with his own eyes the danger, the zombies are about to come bursting out of this dam, it basically now is like all or nothing for this group. Like, you no longer have the army to protect you. They're calling quits and the dam's about to burst. The last note I put is, what is your nature? That's what made me think. Next episode is already our season finale, right?
That's right.
Obviously, this is going to be it. The army's going to take off and the zombies are going to burst free.
And our heroes have to...
They've got to make their first real move. They're going to have to leave the house, right?
And yeah, well, they're going to have to try to find their missing parts and get out or do the best they can.
Can I say who I've been missing the most?
I think I know who you're going to say.
Tobias. Where is he? I hope he's doing well, and I assume that he's going to be scooped up on the way out of town here. I would also like to give mad props to Paul, who easily said that the Grizz was going to be the first one to die.
It's recorded history.
It is recorded history. He called it. He said it was going to be Griselda. I thought she was really going to be the primary storyteller here. She did help with the storytelling, but Papa most definitely has on the wizard storyteller hat and is, I think, going to continue to tell stories.
He sort of reminds me a little bit of Shane from the first show, because he shows you how far you need to go in order to survive this world.
One of the questions that we had in the whole grouping of everyone is, do they take the soldier that they've gnarled his arm up for a love interest for Ophelia? The obvious problem with that is now you've nastied out his arm.
And you haven't instilled a lot of loyalty.
Hells no. So now I'm completely, I don't know, are they going to leave him behind? It seems like we've invested an awful lot of time in him as a character.
I don't know what you do with him.
Okay, so next person. So that's a question mark for Ophelia and love interest, right? Okay, so now my second question is, are they going to pursue some sort of, I don't know, blurred lines business between Chris and Alicia?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
So you think there is going to be some like other more than looks? Will there be actual kissing or more?
Or more.
Whoa, blown away. Travis and Maddie seem like they're holding tight, and by Liza taking herself out of the situation, it a little bit does eliminate some of it. I mean, I guess Chris and Alicia are not technically really, I mean, they don't share parents.
No, they're not related.
So
they're not even step anything, really.
No, they're not.
It's legal in every state.
It's legal now in New York. It's legal in every state. I don't want to know your dating history, Mr. Daly.
This week, I enjoyed the episode about 100 times more than I liked last week's. So
I
much
heard
more.
Some talk that people fell asleep in last week's episode.
We know at least one.
You know who you are.
And so much more happened this week. I know that we needed to get those people into those places last week, you know, the hospital or whatever.
Well, we've added the closer now as obviously a character. Like, he could have been out Griselda,
you know,
for the closer.
I think he could have been brought in.
Could he have just been a neighbor in
a
their neighborhood?
A lot earlier. He should have been brought in a lot earlier, actually. He seems much more interesting.
But here's the thing. When you think about it, the person who has been like a real big question mark, the Salazar family, their story is out there now. Griselda's dead. Papa is told his backstory now, for the most part. We don't need to know exactly every bit of his torture and whatnot, but we kind of get it. And we also get that they've hid it from Ophelia. So she doesn't have a shared history in the same way. So that story kind of ended exactly when the Closer's story is now coming to us as the beginning. So he kind of picks up as the mysterious figure.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out next week.
I can't wait. Actually, I'm actually pretty glad that Nick has a partner in crime here, because I think it makes him a more palatable character when he has somebody who is maybe the brains of the operation. Like, if he's just going to be the one that is kind of the conniving one.
Well, Nick is just like a petty thief and a drug user, whereas this guy seems like he could probably...
He's the brains, right?
He could probably work up a pretty big criminal scheme.
Yeah, but he needs a lackey. He needs somebody who can do that sort of, you know, everybody's got to have a henchman, but right. We were missing the boss, you know? We were missing the big boss man. And so now it's like Nick falls right in line, like, yeah, you're actually a decent henchman, you know? You could be the sidekick. Nick and the Closer. Closer and Nick.
Thanks for listening.
We appreciate it. Have a great time, and we will see you next week for the season finale.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.